You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, August 17th, 2011. Hump Day, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Peter Mouget, president of the Public Investors Arbitration Bar Association, PIABA, on this latest ruling curtailing SEC regulations. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Matt Taibbi. He's got a blockbuster story coming out about the SEC. These corporate thugs, they get you on both ends of it. We'll be talking to Peter Mouget in moments, and lots of news for you. Great story. An empirical breakdown of who the Tea Party is. You won't be surprised. Pentagon, will they privatize their pension fund? Update on the super committee. Civil disobedience coming soon to Washington, D.C. A horrible story about a girl in a school in Missouri. And more, ladies and gentlemen, on the program. Folks, if you want to go see, if you want to go to a town hall and have a meeting with one of your Republican congressmen during their recess, get your wallet out, folks, because now the latest trend in Republican democracy, in Republican town halls, they're charging you to come to the town halls. Representative Paul Ryan, pursuing that Randian dream, that libertarian fantasy, where you literally have to pay to talk to your congressman. He's not holding any face-to-face open to the public town hall meetings during the recess. But Paul Ryan, for $15, you can go to a luncheon and you can ask him questions. Same with Representative Ben Quayle of Arizona. $35, you can ask him a question. Representative Chip Kravac from Minnesota, he is a real bargain at $10 a question. You can ask him at the beauty is they don't call them town hall meetings. What they do is they say, well, we're gonna have it on it's being sponsored by a private entity. That's why they can charge money. We're not going to have a public one. We don't have time. But this way you get to sort of like, you know, filter out the riffraff. As opposed to this program, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I misstated the other day and I was corrected by a listener. I said this show was 50 cents a show. Uh-uh. What the heck is that? Fire truck. No, ladies and gentlemen, this show is not 50 cents a show. This show is 33 cents a show. I've been corrected. 33 cents a show. And I want to read something from listener Corkhead. Well, don't let his nickname. Hey, Sam, I want to mention that I was initially hesitant to become a member because I was only missing, quote, a post show, which implied there was a drop off in quality content quality. I also thought I wouldn't have time to listen to all of it anyway. Glad to see you're now promoting it more as a second half of the show, because there has never been anything close to a drop off. In fact, the past week's member material has been especially compelling radio, and an extra long Friday helps me get through the weekend and Monday. Well, Corkhead, maybe next time you write in, you sound more sophisticated. Like Professor Corkhead or something like that. To solve the time issue, I am using an iPod Nano that allows me to speed up the content so I can listen to a 90-minute show in little over an hour, which better fits my commute. It does make you sound a little coked up, though. That is why, folks, when people write in and say, how come you stutter? How come you say, ah, ah, ah? Or how come you take abnormally long pauses sometimes when you talk? That's why I do it. So that you can speed up what I'm saying. By the way, no sooner had I signed up as a gold Twitter donator, and Senator Al Franken was following me. And that's not a coincidence, folks. I think that's because do we donate your account on the interview I did with him, which was one of the only national media interviews I think that he's done in his 2 years as senator, or was it on the story?
We did the interview, but that was a few months ago, and then we also recently though we did the story about the woman in the public radio saying he was being a meanie by standing up against
Well, folks, we have another offer for you right now, okay? We're going to try this. I've got a lot of emails saying, please, please. I'm not a member, but I really, really want to hear the Marin interview, which I think we only played 3 minutes of it in the first half of the show, and then we saved the rest of it for the second half of the show. We're going to make a deal with you right now. If you contact Matt through at MajorityFM on Twitter, if you really need to, you can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. But better to contact him at MajorityFM and show us and just mention, tell us what your Facebook account is. If you have donated your Facebook account at donateyouraccount.com/MajorityFM, if you donate your Facebook account for one repost a day, we will send you a secret link to that Mark Maron interview. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We are now incenting your donateyouraccount.com/MajorityFM because those punks over at Citizen Radio, those ankle biters, are 20 people ahead of us. Will not stand.
Incentivizing.
It's actually incenting.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you had been listening to the member show all last week, you would have heard me smack Matt around a little bit. And he just got smacked down. Incentivizing, not really
sorry,
a word, buddy.
That.
Incenting. All right. We'll be right back with Peter Mouget. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is always a pleasure to welcome Peter Mouget to the show. He is with Levin Papantonio down in Florida. Obviously, one of my, probably my second favorite law firm in the country, I have to say. Cedar and Chandler's got to go up there first. You know, we got a family business.
As long as we're in the top couple.
Exactly. And, of course, you're the president of the Public Investors Arbitration Bar Association, PIABA, which, as far as I know, is the only organization in the country that actually meets with the SEC or Congress when they're talking about financial regulations on behalf of the rest of us, not finance companies.
We're one of the few groups in the country, that I know of, the only that is consistently representing Main Street to the SEC. We give a whole different perspective than the, you know, one after another lobbyist and financial firms that are lining up at the SEC's door to give their input. So you're exactly right.
And they must just here come the hippies, as it were. But
you know, they've actually been very, the SEC's been very receptive. They have sent very large contingents every time we've shown up to with different groups to listen, and very engaging. And we're going back to provide additional input on the fiduciary duty debate back and forth, and how broad it should be. And it's been very. A very positive experience so far, and I feel like they're receptive and listen to what we have to say.
What is the fiduciary duty debate?
It's under Dodd-Frank. The Dodd-Frank Act mandated that the SEC take a real hard look at the application of a fiduciary duty, a harmonization or a uniform standard between registered investment advisors and broker dealers. It's really interesting. It stems in large part on the consumer, the investor's confusion over the differences in the obligations between registered investment advisors and broker dealers. And the lines are very, very blurry. And the industry argues that registered investment advisors have whole different standards, higher standards than broker dealers. You would be absolutely amazed at what the Merrill Lynches of the world argue behind closed doors of what their duties are to their client. They will argue that they have no fiduciary duty to their investor clients, and the standard for investment advisors is much, much higher. So they run from that standard. So the SEC is looking at providing a minimum standard or a harmonization of those two different camps.
So the brokers argue that they have a much lower standard, and that way they can basically just say we have the same fiduciary responsibility to one of our brokerage clients that we sell stocks to as a guy who sells a sandwich maybe does to a guy who comes in to eat.
You choose which one you want. That's exactly right. You want, you know, have it your way, like you're at Burger King, and we're just here to place orders when we all know that they're providing financial advice to the significant majority of investors that walk in. And investors don't know that. They're shocked.
And certainly
when
they present themselves that way. I mean,
oh, Lord,
that's the point. You know, you see these advertisements, you don't just say like, hey, we're just, you know, we don't know what we're doing, but whatever you want to buy, we'll buy for you.
Sam, you hit the nail on the head. It's what we did with the SEC, and it was almost comical, is we matched up your example is dead on. We matched up the advertisements from the industry with their transcripts and pleadings in court. So trusted advice, you know, retirement planning. I mean, you get it. They're selling that they are a one-stop shop for retirement planning, investment advice, and then you flip the page to the next tab and you see them arguing, we have no fiduciary duty, we don't give investment advice, we just sell stocks, we're just brokers. It's almost comical. And the SEC's got the bullseye's on this, and I think they're going to knock it out of the park on this one. We're cautiously optimistic.
Well, I appreciate your optimism and your caution in that regard. But let's move on to this other story that I wanted to talk to you about, because you know, I have become about a week or two ago, and I don't know if you're familiar with some of his work, but a guy named Bill Lozanik, who is from the Center for Industrial Competitiveness, walked me through the whole sort of corruption of corporations because of the stock options that CEOs get, essentially creating a I guess, agendas for CEOs and for management of corporations that are not necessarily consistent with the way that the rest of us perceive the way corporations should be operating. Rather than basically turning them into, CEOs have like a little cottage industry, which is getting the stock prices up regardless of what it means for the long-term functioning of a company. And, you know, regardless of what it means in terms of their role in the context of society. And this story that came out about this appeals decision, I think is very much in line with that. Tell us about this is a recent court appeals court decision that may junk part of this Dodd-Frank.
I love your description, and there is a whole underlying problem that that Dodd-Frank 14A was trying to address with this proxy access rule. What essentially happened is you have the Section 14A, which the SEC generated, that says major shareholders, 3% or more, with some other qualifiers, can put individuals or nominate individuals to be on the board of directors. And that nomination can go out with the corporation's proxy material. Seems pretty reasonable.
Yeah, now break this down for us. I mean, just so that people understand, because I'm not sure if everybody understands even that level of structure in a corporation. You have a board of directors who are appointed by whom, and what are they supposed to do?
Well, the board of directors is appointed within. So when somebody rolls off, the board of directors will nominate a new individual to fill that spot. Now, this is really important because the directors are the ones that set corporate strategy, but most importantly, the tie-in to your point, is executive compensation. So it's almost like a back scratch. I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. The board puts together the package of compensation for the top executives, like the CEO. And so the board will nominate their cronies. It's just this repetitive nature. But
how do people get on the board in the first place?
It's typically, it's almost a little incestuous. I mean, they're paid gigs and high paid gigs for the amount of time that you put in. And they're typically folks that have achieved, you know, a high level in their field and are put on, or, you know, prominent individuals that come onto these boards. But it's all of this, don't upset the apple cart. You're not going to get asked to be on if you're somebody that goes in and starts really changing things up or suggesting, you know, different ways to manage. And keep in mind, their obligation is to oversee management and make sure that the corporation's running effectively. So the way it's set up, there's a conflict walking in the door that you need to kind of fall in line with the status quo. And that's why this new SEC rule was so important, is it gave major shareholders an opportunity to get on the ballot without having to essentially perform a write-in candidacy. I mean, it's almost like saying, I want to run for governor. You can't get on the ballot, and you have to fund and implement your own write-in candidacy. Well, we all know that's almost impossible, and it's almost the same for these boards.
So you got this board. You got this board, and basically what they do is, of a public company, they nominate a slate of people that they want to replace anybody who his term is up on the board. And if you are a shareholder and you want to nominate somebody else, or the hurdle to nominate somebody and get them on the ballot is so great that it virtually is impossible. So this board keeps basically bringing on people and nominating people that they know are going to agree with them. So there's no diversity of opinion as to what should be happening with this company.
Sure. If you're on the board, you get to nominate. A major shareholder in the company cannot. And this rule changed that and said if you own more than 3%, either an investor or a group of investors, you can nominate your own person to the board, which seems healthy. I mean, on its face is healthy. competition that diverging or different opinions, you can get somebody else on the board as opposed to the current board member, just that perpetuation of the same philosophy.
And so what did this three-court panel of appeals, Republican, I should say, appointed judges, what did they find?
All three of them are Republican appointed. They found that the SEC didn't do their homework, essentially. They said you didn't do enough study, enough analysis to determine the negative impact and the cost this would impose on the corporations. So they struck it. They overrode it. Of course, it's also real important to see who the plaintiffs or the movements were trying to overturn this. It was the United States Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable, which essentially represents upper-level senior management, you know, executive-type management. So you've got big business attacking the SEC saying, you all didn't do your homework. You didn't study this. You didn't run the empirical data. And the SEC, I'm sorry, the court said, we agree with you, big business, and this thing should be struck. And
now, with that said, the SEC had 80 pages of cost-benefit analysis on this, right?
Yes. I mean, to argue that they didn't do anything or that the SEC didn't meet the standards here, didn't do their homework, is ridiculous. Now, keep in mind, what you're trying to quantify and prove empirically is very, very difficult. Like, how does it make the corporation work more effectively? I mean, that's not something that you can quantify easily. But as you just said, there were over 80 pages of analysis of the cost benefit and the empirical studies, and the court said it wasn't enough. What you've got here is legislation legislated from the bench. I mean, to override this at this point with what we just went through in the markets is a travesty.
Peter, let me ask you something. What possible regulation? I mean, first off, there's two questions. One, is there in any circumstance, could you actually predict whether something is going to be beneficial to the company's bottom line or not? I mean, if everybody could do that, wouldn't every company be wildly successful?
Yeah, if you could identify this with precision, and the point is, the standard the court set will bring regulatory or new regulation to a screeching halt.
Well, that's what the other question is. Is regulation even necessarily set up to always profit a company, but rather to make it more equitable and more just and make it not a scam for the people who are public shareholders?
Well, there's got to be a balance, and there's got to be a balance between the efficiency and the bottom line and a policy argument. And obviously the court has said that that balancing test towards the efficiency and the costs weren't adequately analyzed. But the analysis that I've reviewed was very thorough on a very difficult issue. But the bottom line is this impacts executive pay in large extent. And Sam, the trickle down here, and why this is important to regular folks, like, you know, just regular investors like you and I, mom and pop investors, is this. Think about these companies that have gone under, AIG, Lehman, Enron, you name it. The problem that this piece, the SEC, was trying to address is that we pay our executives, and you started off with this, with the options and the derivatives, and you're dead on, is the problem is that the way we pay our CEOs is profits of a corporation, which seems reasonable on its face, stock price. The higher the stock price, the more money these guys make. Now, the problem is it compensates them. It promotes taking excessive short-term risk. So every one of those companies I just mentioned, AIG, Enron, Lehman, Bear Stearns, all bet the farm, the short-term farm, on excess derivative trades, undisclosed risks, significant risk that would drive the stock price up. Now, from 2000 to 2008, the plan worked great. Early 2008, the stock prices on these companies all went up. But as you know, when everything went south in 2008, these guys, the CEOs and the executive, took billions off the table in short-term compensation over those years, and the companies failed, and there was no clawback. So what's driving this is the SEC was trying to get independent voices to curtail excessive CEO compensation and how they were paid. Different.
Right. It's not even the amount necessarily as much as it is the incentive structure that they're setting up for these CEOs do not necessarily benefit the long-term health of the corporation.
No, and it's not hard to figure out, Sam. I mean, the AIG has redone their compensation package for their CEO, for instance, and it's called their long-term units. And 80% of the compensation packages for the CEO at AIG is now based on bonds, which is much more indicative of the health of the corporation, the value of the bonds, and 20% on stock price, mm-hmm. which is a much longer-term approach and takes away that incentive for driving up the stock price on short-term risks and taking money off the table. That's why they challenged. That's why big business challenged this independent voice on these boards and the mechanism to get them on the boards. It was in large part the way this whole system works.
Because they all basically just want to suck a company dry, to the detriment not only of the other shareholders. I mean, let's be frank. Everything that went on in 2008 hurt people, whether you were invested in the stock market or not. Well, maybe it was you were just a pensioner and you didn't realize you were a shareholder of a company, or maybe you were just someone who lost their job because of the destruction of our financial system.
It affects every one of us, and it impacts. You're exactly right. And let me give you another example. If you are a taxpayer, which we all are, and your local pension plan for your city, your municipality, your firefighters, most of them are backed financially by the city that these folks. So if you're a city employee of a city in Florida, you as the taxpayer are financially backing the pension system. The pension system gets crushed in 2008 based on these, in large part based on these risks taken by the executive teams. The taxpayer's footing the bill in the pension plan. We're all directly responsible for the bill for this thing.
So, Peter, what happens next with this case?
I don't know. It's going to be interesting. The SEC is kind of being close-lipped as far as whether they're going to try to rewrite, take it to the next court. I certainly hope they pursue this. I think it's very important that we address how executives are paid, and I like the way they did this, and that let's get some independent voices on these boards to take away that conflict on how these corporations are putting everything on black so I can make money this year rather than looking at long term. And who better than a major shareholder of a company to champion that cause? It's a very reasonable approach. The amount of money that we're talking that the court says that wasn't analyzed is de minimis compared to the ramifications when you look at that laundry list of companies that have gone under because of these types of derivative trading.
All right. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us. We got to take a break. Peter Mouget from Levin Papantonio and Piaba. We'll put a link up on the site. Thanks again, Peter.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate it.
All right. We got to take a break, folks. When we come back, I've got a lot of stories for you. We'll be right back after this. So, folks, who is the Tea Party? Our politics supposedly have been dominated by them for the past 2 years. We were told these are people who are just people who have never been involved in politics before. They're people who are just so outraged at the profligate spending of this country. They're just about fiscal discipline, and all they care about is finances. They've never been involved in the politics. They come from all walks of life. They're Democrats. They're independents. They're Republicans. They're black. They're white. And they just care about fiscal discipline, and that's why they've got such a stranglehold on our politics. They're so important. Heck, CNN right now is probably dispatching an entire camera crew just because I'm talking about them. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it turns out none of that is true.
Surprise, surprise.
It's what I've been saying since day one about these people. It's what many other people have been saying about them. And now we have empirical proof. And of course, if you're a Tea Partier, the words empirical proof mean we have actual data, numbers. And of course, if you're a Tea Partier, at this point, this is when you check out because you say, I don't believe in that. David Campbell, Robert Putnam, one is an associate professor of political science at Notre Dame. The other, a professor of public policy at Harvard. Well, of course, they're professors. What do they know? Numbers? Give me a break. Not only is the Tea Party an incredibly toxic brand now for the American people, it is also the disapproval of the Tea Party is climbing. In 2010, a New York Times CBS News survey found that 18% of Americans had an unfavorable opinion of it, 21% had a favorable opinion, 46% had not heard enough. 14 months later, support has slipped to 20%, and their opponents have doubled to 40%. The Tea Party ranks lower than any of the 23 other groups we asked about, lower than both Republicans and Democrats. It is even less popular than the much maligned groups like atheists and Muslims. Interestingly, one group that approaches it in unpopularity is the Christian right.
Ooh.
Huh. I wonder why that may be. We all recall the famous founding father. No, I'm sorry. The famous Tea Partier dressed as a founding father who was at a press conference saying, we will give up the taxes if they repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. If they repeal the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And despite the fact that there is some movement amongst Americans, still not a majority, who want a smaller government and oppose redistribution of income, et cetera, et cetera. These researchers have found that, in fact, contrary to the story that Tea Partiers are nonpartisan, they're just Americans who are upset about the spending. I never voted before in my life. I came out here to this Tea Party rally because I saw what was going on in this country, and I went, no part of it. It's not about party. Well, it turns out that these researchers who interviewed 3,000 Americans back in 2006 to track their political affiliations have found that past Republican affiliation is the single strongest predictor of Tea Party support today. Not whether you care about fiscal discipline, not whether you care about the spending, not whether you, it doesn't matter. If you are a strong, long-time Republican partisan, that is the most indicative of your support of the Tea Party. And it's not a creature of the Great Recession. People who have suffered from this economy are no more likely to become Tea Partiers than anyone else. So what do Tea Partiers have in common? Folks, sit down for this one. This is going to be shocking. They are overwhelmingly white. But even compared to other white Republicans, they had a low regard for immigrants and blacks long before Barack Obama was president, and they still do.
Surprise, surprise.
Oh, I'm going to have a heart attack. More important, they were disproportionately social conservatives in 2006. What? You mean it's not about fiscal discipline? It's just about the same old moral majority that we have known over the past 40 years from the Republican Party. Next to being a Republican, That means the number two determinant factor as to whether or not you are a Tea Party supporter after being a Republican was a desire back in 2006, before there was a Tea Party, to see religion play a prominent role in politics. Who knew? I mean, me. I knew. They seek, quote, deeply religious elected officials, approve of religious leaders engaging in politics, and want religion brought into political debates. The Tea Party generals may say their overriding concern is smaller government, but not their rank and file, who are more concerned about putting God in government. So unless the Tea Party was about the about getting around Jesus and having him come back and taking over government, they are misappropriately named. And so when you wonder why Michelle Bachmann, this Reconstructionist Christianist, this Dominionist Christianist, is so popular with the Tea Party, I got news for you. It's not about her economic policies. It's about the fact that she's submissive to her husband. There you go, folks. The Tea Party in a nutshell. Meanwhile, the super committee. Well, I guess I should put this out there. You know, we talked yesterday in the second half of the show. And I, you know what? I'm going to take heart to what this guy had said, this writer, reader, listener, emailer. The post show is in no way less than the pre-show. In fact, I'm no longer going to call it the post show. If I call it a post show, I'll put a quarter in a jar. And then at the end of the month, I get to spend the quarter. It is the better show. The better half. Hmm? Huh?
I like that. Sounds good.
The better half. Yesterday in the better half, I broke down the latest on the News Corp scandal, and it is huge. The story broke moments before we got on air, and so the first I heard about it was in the Guardian newspaper, and then the rest of the day people were talking about this. But the Murdochs are in big trouble. Once you become a member at Majority FM, you can go back and listen to that second half of the show. Easy as peasy, ladies and gentlemen. Meanwhile, in the Super Committee, Super Congress, we've got to come up with another way of referring to it, because it's really going to be the Screw You Congress. There's no doubt in my mind, ladies and gentlemen, that they're going to cut our Medicare. They're going to cut maybe Social Security by means of an inflation index. And they're going to screw our economy. President Obama on the stump yesterday basically saying that he's going to recommend that lawmakers maybe put out there a specific plan for stimulus and job growth to be part of the super committee's package that they're going to be sending to both houses of Congress and to the president. If they don't, there's a trigger. Guess what, folks? That trigger's not going to be pulled. I guarantee it, though not so much that I would actually give you anything if I'm wrong. But he is looking for a package that's bigger than $1.5 trillion. So I don't know. You know, that leads me to believe that maybe he does want the trigger pulled. I just don't know. But it's so hard to believe that these guys won't come together to screw Americans. Patty Murray, Max Baucus, John Kerry did an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. We know that our goal is to reduce spending, but we also know that America faces not just a budget deficit, but a jobs deficit. Nobody on the committee would be happy if we reduce the budget deficit, but even more Americans end up losing their jobs. So we are ready to get to work with our colleagues on both sides of the... Whatever. My sense is that we're all going to regret that the windsurfing on Nantucket not so good this year. Believe me, that is my sense. And you should know, folks, when we talk about corporate tax holidays, repatriation, I'll try and remember to bring that up with Taibbi. I'm going to be interviewing him later this afternoon for tomorrow's program. He's got this blockbuster story coming out, and I want to get on it as soon as I could. He wasn't available for tomorrow. So the dude did me a solid, and we're going to talk today, even before the story comes out. I say no more about how I could do an interview like that. Wall Street Journal noted the other day that non-financial companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index were holding $1.12 trillion in cash. Very nice. I guess we don't really need these corporations to have more money so that they will create jobs. I mean, at what point can we put down this lie that corporations need more money to hire people? They hire people when demand goes up. We have an aggregate demand problem in this country. And we know that when we hear the words shared sacrifice, that means, well, it means basically all of us will be sacrificing except for the very wealthy. And Frank emails me, says, I keep hearing about shared sacrifice. Since I bought my house 4.5 years ago and my income has declined, here's what I've given up. All the equity in my house. Yard service. I'm putting off car maintenance that really needs to get done. Home maintenance. Dining out. Never used to think much about this. Now it's only an occasional treat. Donating to my favorite podcast, yours, which he has put off. That's understandable. Healthcare. Over the years, my policy has changed from a low-deductible PPO to a policy with a $4,000 deductible. I'm skipping treatment for back pain because I can't afford to pay for the doctor's visits. Actually, that's exactly what Republicans prescribe for healthcare insurance. What you are now, you don't think of yourself as skipping treatment for back pain. Think of yourself as a wiser medical consumer. How much would we have to tax a billionaire or even a deca millionaire so that their standard of living would change even 1% as much as mine? How much would you have to increase taxes on a Koch brother for them to put off maintenance on a corporate jet? How much would you have to raise the taxes on a Walton for them to have to defer their health care? How much would you have to raise taxes on Richard Mellon's scape before he's forced to do his own landscaping? At what marginal tax rate would force Daryl Issa to delay an oil change or the 100,000-mile service in his car? I could ask also, you could keep going on and on with this. What percentage of tax increase would John Kerry need to stop dining out? Make his own food. What percentage increase would you have to ask of most of the commentators you see on TV before they decide, I know my friends are getting together for dinner tonight, but I'm going to show up maybe for a drink afterwards because I can't afford to eat dinner. I would submit the number that it would take an increase in taxes to change that behavior of any of those people has not been discussed in 50 years in this country. I don't know if the words have ever been even uttered on television. What percent increase in taxes would change the behavior of people making $700,000 a year, $1 million a year, $5 million a year? Yeah, you know, I think if my top marginal rate went up to 90% and I was paying 90% on every dollar I earned over $10 million, I might not get that eighth house. Honestly, I might defer getting that eighth house for another year or two, but I got to talk to my accountant. All right, folks. Now we move on to the better half. You can IM me in that better half of the program at Majority FM. You can call me 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Ladies and gentlemen, you can join me in the better half if you become a member of the Majority Report. Remember, I've got some hard thinking to do. Make it easier for me, ladies and gentlemen, please. Make it easier for me to continue this program. If you can't afford it, we've had some people cancel because they can't afford it. Please, I'm not speaking to you. Understand that. I don't know why it is that the people who feel guilty are the people who are suffering the most hardship. And I'm not trying to guilt anybody. I'm trying to ask for your support for a product that you enjoy. And incidentally, if you buy any crap through Amazon, buy it through our link. And if you drink coffee or eat chocolate or drink tea, and you like great coffee, tea, or chocolate, and you want to support a great company that is employee-owned and gives a fair deal to their suppliers, you got to go to justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. There's no better way. That's a win, 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 win. And donateyouraccount.com so that those tattooed young whippersnappers from Citizens Radio don't beat us in the donate your account wars. And if you donate your account at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm, if you donate your Facebook account for one repost a day, you are eligible for the secret link to the Marin interview that you didn't get if you're not a member. We got to do more of that. All right, folks. See you in the better half.